The ideas put forth in these early Indian forest dwellings were indeed revolutionary. Buddha taught that truth was not the exclusive realm of priests, and that salvation had nothing to do with caste, ritual, or offerings.
In India, at that time, we're talking about Brahmanic India, the laws of Manu, the caste system, and women were in a very strict submission to men. Woman had no real being except through man, and particularly in religion. There was no such thing as a woman who had any access to religion at all. So then you had the Buddha, and he, first of all, allowed in people from all the different levels of society. He was very revolutionary in that sense. And he also allowed women in. At that time, you know, he had established a monastic order, a male monastic order. He then established, very shortly after that, a monastic order for women. So it was one of the very few world religions which, right at its inception, had these women in it.
We cannot dismiss the fact that every human being, while they may transcend their time and society, are a part of their time and society. I'll give you an example of what I mean. The Shakyamuni Buddha was a person who had achieved an enlightenment that was complete, final, and total. But he had some reservations, apparently, about allowing women to enter the Sangha, to enter the congregation, because it was his belief that it would be disruptive. The story goes that his cousin Ananda was able to trap him by simply asking if it were true that all sentient beings could eventually become Buddhas. And of course, the historical Buddha said yes. This is true for men, is it also true for women? The historical Buddha said yes. Therefore, his mother and other female members of his family were allowed to form a Sangha of their own, because he had to admit, even though he was a man of his time and place, which considered women to be basically chattel, that it was possible for all sentient beings to reach enlightenment.
Monastic communities were dynamic cooperative experiments where ideas were freely shared. The same spirit exists to this day in Buddhist monasteries and centers all over the world. Thich Nhat Hanh is an exiled Vietnamese monk and peace activist. He was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. for his work during and after the Vietnam War. Here he describes the spirit and necessity of Sangha, community.
You can imagine a community like this of 150 or 200 persons listening to the bell, breathing serenely, peacefully, smiling. Suddenly 200 Buddhas begin to chime within. And that is very important for the world. The light of understanding, the light of love is needed for our survival. Therefore, we have to give the Buddha in ourselves a chance.
These religious communities grew up rapidly around the Buddha. He gathered many disciples in the 50 years he spent walking India's dusty roads after his enlightenment. He taught in the language of the common folk, using parables and anecdotes to describe the origin of human suffering and the way to overcome it. Part of the Buddha's phenomenal popularity was the way he reinterpreted traditional Indian concepts like karma and nirvana from a psychological point of view, giving them a fresh and dynamic appeal.
The history of Buddhism is really the history of, the story of people who have come with a real practical experience of this kind of slowing up, and have attempted to transmit that experience or to trick other people into having that experience in a way. Once that's done, then it's every man, woman, and child on their own, in a sense.
At first, Buddha's followers adhered to the way of life usual to monks at the time, wandering, meditating in the forest, wearing rags, and begging for food. In time, Buddha permitted those who wished to live near a village for ease of access to food. Begging had always been an accepted way of life in many Asian countries. In fact, necessity had made it something of a virtue. The The monks, whose discipline prevented them from working to provide for themselves, would benefit from the laity's gifts of food, clothing, and housing. The laity would benefit from the teaching of the monks and would gain merit as a result of giving. Begging was also seen as an avenue to purity for the monks, teaching them the virtue of curbing one's pride and learning to have few desires. This community of monks, the Sangha, was the strength of Buddhism in the early days.
The monastic community was his army. Do you understand? It was just the time of the imperialistic exterior military physical army, an arms race beginning. And the Buddha put down an antidote. He said he created this institution of an other kind of army of monks and nuns, propertyless, who would never kill another being, who would be killed before kill. Their heroism lay in that they would be killed before killing. They would be willing to die not to kill anybody. They were international. They belonged to no nation. They had no nationalism. They had no property, so nothing to defend. They accepted gift from anybody. And their whole lifetime was focused on attaining enlightenment and education and creating some liberated minds and then teaching others in exchange for being supported by the societies, teaching those societies in which they existed, and serving as a balancing antidote for the army, you know, the violent armies. It was like a nonviolent army. Okay, clear? It was a revolution, in fact. That's a total revolution he created, much more powerful than a political revolution, which he could have done. He could have gone up back to his own country where he had been going to be the king. He could have said, "Dad, I'm taking over." He wouldn't even have to fight. His dad would have been delighted. "That's great, I'm going to Florida." So he would have taken over his own country and then ordered everybody to meditate, turned his country into a Dharma center. He could have easily done it, but then what? The Dharma would have been perceived as what that country does. The religion of that country, it then would have been unacceptable to the neighboring countries with their armies. So instead, he remained homeless. And as a homeless person, he created a vast army of homeless beings. So non-competing beings, he created this kind of army. History since then can be seen as a competition between the Buddha's peace army and the war army. And his community of free beings was the antidote to the armies that were in the beginning of the arms race that we have not quite yet finished with today. You know, we think of the arms race as something now in modern time, but the arms race really began in Buddha's time. Do you ever think about what the Trojan War really was all about? What the Mahabharata War in India was really all about?
Robert Thurman describes the Buddha's rejection of violence.
They are the beginning of the arms race. They chronicle the beginning of the arms race. You know, Achilles is like Agamemnon, is like Colin Powell, you know, General Crow. No, they're the archetype of them. Because what happened was an old warrior ethic that was a tribal thing of sort of, you know, macho, you know, buck deers out there banging heads in the spring before, like, dividing up the herd, you know. This, which was then in a tribal situation, was sort of the notion of warfare as a kind of competitive dance between tribes before they settled down for their year-long food gathering and cultivating, whatever it is they did. But they were just sort of modest things, and the heroism was just to sort of stake out their territory for them to thrive and prosper in. But then with the time of the Trojan War, people began to have agricultural organization, bureaucracy, surplus. They could keep an army in the field. They had peasants. They could have infantry and soldiers. They could keep an army in the field all year round. They weren't content to just butt heads with, you know, Agamemnon with Hector, and then one go back over there and go over there after fighting over some girls, and then relax in their own places. No, they had to genocide the whole Trojans, all of them. Because warfare, the arms race, had begun, and this old ethic of the warrior was destructive to life, in fact. And this happened in the Buddha's time, and the time of Socrates. So the arms race begins right when Buddhism begins. It's really crucial to understand. So the Buddha would have been part of the arms race if he hadn't become a Buddha. Because he was a king, he would have had an army, he knew how to run an army. When he was a prince, he took an elephant and flipped it 7 miles with his toe. He was pretty macho guy. He loved his wife. You know, he was really heavy duty. And so, luckily, he switched out of that. He saw that was useless. He rejected it. And he said, there's another thing to do, which is this. He saw freedom. Why kill someone? Why fight? Yeah.
During the monsoon season, when it was difficult to move about, the monks built temporary shelters in the forest. This kind of rain retreat, as the practice came to be known, fostered the development of communal life among the monks. In time, the institutionalized almsgiving was curtailed. The monks increasingly spent more time on scholarship and less time in meditation practice. Buddhist scholar Robert Thurman was the first American to become an ordained Tibetan monk. Here he describes the importance of meditation in Buddhist practice.
Where meditation really fits in Buddhism correctly is when you get a better understanding of the world. At first, it's only intellectual. You sort of reason your way to a better understanding, you know. And your habits and your instincts are still stuck on the old misunderstanding. So that's where meditation comes in. Meditation makes you realize your understanding, if you will, you see. If you don't have understanding to start with to drive the meditation, then meditation will not bring you a new understanding, actually. Meditation will just calm you down within your structure of misunderstanding.
After half a century of teaching, Buddha died at the age of 81 after eating some poison mushrooms, or bad pork, as some say. He left behind a vigorous and already widespread movement with many disciples, and a monastic structure that grew steadily to become one of the most powerful institutions in Indian society for hundreds of years, eventually spreading to the rest of Asia, and in recent years to the West. Buddha appointed no successor, but instead instructed his followers that his teachings, called Dharma, should be their guide. His last words were said to be, "Decay is inherent in all compound things. Work out your salvation with diligence." Some say his final words were, "Walk on." For the next 400 years, Buddha's teachings were transmitted orally by schools of reciters. Buddhist scripture from this period reflects the memorizing tricks of any oral tradition: repetition, rhyme, numerical lists. Eventually, as histories, codes, interpretations, and commentaries swelled the growing body of Buddhist scripture, the monks started writing everything down. That's when things started getting really interesting. Various groups had been developing individual approaches to the common Buddhist goal. Distinctive schools of thought began to emerge in the Sangha, many reflecting the influence of Greek and Persian invaders. Many new scriptures or sutras were written. Between 200 BC and 200 AD, doctrinal disputes developed as two distinct tendencies became apparent within the movement, progressive and conservative. Great councils were convened to discuss and debate the differences between the two groups, who had become known as the two vehicles, the Mahayana, or Great Vehicle, and the Hinayana, or Compact Vehicle. Of the 18 original Hinayana sects, only one remains, the Theravada, or Way of the Elders, the more orthodox branch. The rise of Mahayana Buddhism represents a dynamic and flexible interpretation of Buddhist doctrine. It presented reforms in theory and practice that made it more appealing to ordinary people, stating that lay people had as much chance for enlightenment as monks. In early Buddhism, there were few rituals or ceremonies in which laymen could participate. The new devotional aspects introduced by Mahayana stimulated the imagination of the lay Buddhists and bound them more tightly to the Sangha.
In the early days of Southern Buddhism, the Sangha was pretty much the ordained priesthood. But with the shift to the Mahayana, maybe 2,000 years ago, it has become clear that the Sangha is all beings. The three treasures of Buddhism are the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The Buddha, realization, and the Dharma, understanding the way things are, and the Sangha is the kinship, the community. And this is the Buddhist Trinity. There's nothing more basic.
In Mahayana, a new type of spiritual hero appears, something like a Buddhist saint, the Bodhisattva, a being striving for enlightenment, not for him or herself alone, but is vowed to help other beings achieve Buddhahood before entering Nirvana themselves.
In Mahayana Buddhism, we have something called the Bodhisattva vow. Basically, we say we're not going to cross to the other shore, which is a kind of euphemism for getting enlightened in this case. We're not going to cross to the other shore unless everybody crosses with us. We put others above ourselves or before ourselves in terms of action. That's the Bodhisattva activity. That we don't get enlightened for ourselves, or we don't try to get enlightened for ourselves. That the view of what we're doing is not, well, I'll get enlightened and then everything else around me will fall into place. Only by helping others will my life fall into place. So that there's a kind of a sequential thing here. Like I think in some of the other teachings, there's a sense of, well, first I'll get enlightened and then I'll help everybody else. And in the Mahayana Buddhism, in the Bodhisattva vow, it doesn't work like that. We say, I'll help everybody else, and then then at the end of that, if everybody's enlightened before me, then I'll work on myself. Of course, all the time you're working on yourself, because helping others is nothing other than working on yourself.
Devotional cults began to arise around various bodhisattvas, a chance for lay people to participate more fully in religious life. At the same time Mahayana was developing wider appeal to lay people of India, its monks were developing highly abstract philosophies which come very close to modern-day scientific thought. By the time of Christ, the schism was complete. Monasteries came to be identified as either Mahayana or Theravada. Eventually, the two traditions coexisted without strife, sometimes sharing a monastery. The third and last flowering of Indian Buddhism was the esoteric Vajrayana, or diamond vehicle tradition, which emerged around the 5th century. Vajrayana incorporated yoga techniques, mystical symbolism, and expanded the role of the teacher, or guru, in the transmission of doctrine. As elaborate and entrenched as they were, in time, however, almost all the schools of Buddhism died out in India. After a long period of preeminence in Indian spiritual life as the official state religion, Buddhism began to lose its grip on the hearts and minds of the people. After several centuries of decline, Buddhism in India was dealt a final blow. All its monasteries were destroyed by Muslim invaders in the 13th century. But by then it had firmly established itself in many other Asian cultures. As early as the 3rd century BC, Buddhism had reached the island of Sri Lanka off the tip of India, brought by Buddhist missionaries sent by a zealous Buddhist Indian Emperor Ashoka. Continuing its steady flow, Buddhism had spread to Burma, Siam, Sumatra, and then across Asia to Vietnam and on to Indonesia. The merchants, caravaneers, and holy men traveling the Silk Route, that great ancient trading artery that stretched from the deserts of Africa and Arabia deep into Asia, brought Buddhism to China in the 1st century AD. In China, the monks encountered a culture more than 2,000 years old with its own advanced spiritual systems, Confucianism and Taoism firmly in place. The Dharma, Buddhist doctrine, adapted and assimilated, and in due course, several distinctly Chinese forms of Buddhism developed. Chan, Tian Tai, and Pure Land, whose bodhisattva Amitabha developed a powerful cult. Chinese monks carried the Chan and other forms of Buddhism to Korea in the late 4th century BC, where it became known as Sun, later called Zen. Korean diplomatic missions brought Sun and other Buddhist traditions to Japan in the 6th century. Eventually, it established itself as a complement to the native religion Shintoism. Subsequent direct contact between Japan and China brought Pure Land Buddhism to Japan, where it is today the largest sect. Esoteric, magical Buddhism from China became Shingon in Japan. Buddhism reached Tibet in the 7th century. There it embraced and subdued the spirit cults of the indigenous Bonpo religion, adding elements of magic and Mahayana metaphysics to create tantric Buddhism. In each country, Buddhist practice took on the cultural and artistic forms and adapted many of the existing philosophical and religious ideas of that culture. Each age and place created its own version, keeping the tradition alive and responsive to the needs of its followers. And gradually, over generations, Buddhist teachings rechanneled and softened the warlike spirit of many of the peoples they touched. Go with loving kindness, as the Buddhists say. Now this stream of compassionate wisdom has reached our own shores to leave its mark on our culture and values. Norman Fisher is a Zen priest and head abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center.
We live in a very confused and troubled world right now. I think ecological issues and political issues have sort of, over the last generations, fallen off the edge of what was going on and developing for many generations, and suddenly we find ourselves in a new and very frightening and confusing situation. And it's my belief that spiritual practice has a lot to offer in general in that situation. I think people today can't really survive psychologically and in a wholesome way without some spiritual orientation in their lives. I think everybody needs that now. And we're getting away from the idea of religion as this is the truth. You know, if you believe in Christ in this way, this is the truth. If you believe in Buddha in this way, this is the truth. And we're beginning to understand that through all these different ways, there is a core system of values and practices and ways of behaving that everybody needs to tap into. So I think that Buddhism, because it has survived intact in Asia over all these generations with a mystical, an organized mystical way of accessing spiritual practice, has a lot to offer right now in the West particularly. And what that is a way of practicing that's relevant to you regardless of your spiritual orientation. Whether you're an atheist or a Christian or a Jew, you can meditate, you can learn something about the ethical teachings of Buddhism, and it's not in any way a requirement that you be a quote-unquote Buddhist. I think in our temple here, we welcome all kinds of people to come and practice, as long as they're willing to do the schedule and do the program. It doesn't matter what they believe in. Some of them will go back to their churches or their synagogues or their wats or their ashrams and continue the practice that they've been doing there. Others will find themselves staying here and helping with the practice and becoming ordained and making a life of it. But that doesn't really matter however you choose to do it. Whatever way you continue, you're doing the ongoing practice. So I think more than any of the other traditions at this moment in time, Buddhism has this self-conscious understanding. We can offer our practice to whoever.
Journalist Scoop Nisker has practiced Buddhism for over 20 years.
Arnold Toynbee, the great historian, said that the arrival of Buddhism in the West, it will be the most significant thing that happens in the 20th century, and I firmly believe that's true. What that means is that it will provide the basis of the new paradigm. Ours is currently not working. Our philosophy, our ideas of super rationality and domination of nature, and the lifting of the human out of nature, and the pride, and it just isn't working.
Woke up this morning, there was trouble in my mind. I tried some meditation, but no peace could I find. Called up my guru, I asked him what to do. He said, son, you just gotta remember that first noble truth. You were born to suffer, you were born to pay some dues. And that path keeps getting longer when you got the Buddha blues. Well, money will bring you problems and love will make you cry. Sometimes it seems like life is just a bitch and then you die. But Buddha says desire is what keeps you from being free. And I'm craving for this and I'm craving for that, and it just won't let me be. Gonna leave me to suffer, gonna leave me to pay my dues. And that path keeps getting longer when you got the Buddha blues. Well, Christian people believe you go to heaven or you go to hell. The Jews believe Messiah's yet to come, gonna judge this life so well. Some people believe it don't mean nothing in the end, but the Buddha done told me I'm gonna come back and do it again and again and again. Be reborn to suffer, be reborn to pay my dues. And that path keeps getting longer when you got the Buddha blues. Well, we're all born in ignorance in a world of greed and hate. Maybe things will get better when we reincarnate. We won't have so many problems, our next life will be fine. As long as we don't get a body, Lord, as long as we don't get a mind. Won't have to suffer so much, won't have to pay so many dues. And that path may get a little shorter. Won't have so many. Won't have so many Buddha blues.
Really, the essence of what we're importing from the East, I think, is the ways of investigating the self, the mind, the body, and who we are. And that is a technique we've only had it here in the West through psychology in the last, you know, 100 years, but they've had it for centuries in the East in a much more, I think, profound way, in that their investigation is not the story, not the storyline of the mind, the drama of the mind, but the mechanics of the mind. In other words, they don't study your human condition, they study the human condition. Now, of course, we have, you know, all the schools of Buddhism are available in this country, and there are different people go for different reasons. Some people like devotion, and some people like you know, psychological investigation, and some people like the cosmology of Buddhism, the vastness. It fits our scientific understanding of the world. But all the parts of it fit, will add to the mix, and hopefully will benefit all sentient beings.
Well, we've come to the end of this now. This is Richard Gere wishing you all supreme happiness and the causes of future happiness. Walk on.
East Meets West was produced by Pamela Michael and Sue Supriano and written by Pamela Michael. Interviews were by Sue Supriano. Our engineer was Matt Binder. The production was funded in part by the California Council for the Humanities, the Tides Foundation, the Numata Center for Buddhist Translation and Research, Buddhist Churches of America, Richard Gere, Stephen Rockefeller, Virginia Warner, Pamela Krasny, and Brian Gibson. Special thanks to the Institute of Buddhist Studies, KPFA Radio, David Gans, and especially to Richard Gere for his narration and support. For information about this program, write to the Buddhist Radio Project, 1602 Delaware Street, Berkeley, California, 94703.